We're at 60 right now. It's just about 12 noon. I'm Kevin Kelly. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music and more. And our connection today is with both professor of musicology, Gabriel Solis, at the University of Illinois School of Music, and by way of him, pianist Thelonious Monk, a great pianist, a jazz bop pianist, however you want to characterize him, which is probably a challenge in any event. Gabriel wrote a book about him called Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making. It just won him an award. And I thought we'd sort of talk around the book and mostly talk about Thelonious Monk and hear lots of his music. That's on today's Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet from a disc of his called Reflections on Duke, playing the music of Duke Ellington, and the emphasis on the reflections. He seems to sort of work around a single petal of a rose, and sort of offered that up as quite a contrast to what we're going to be hearing next. First of all, it's a mostly classical player dealing with a jazz great, and you can debate how well or not. We're going to hear one of the jazz greats himself, Thelonious Monk, as part of our conversation with Gabriel Solis, who is associate professor of musicology at the University of Illinois School of Music. And I had heard of him really through the director of the school, Carl Kramer, who I was talking with early in the summer about some folks in his department who might be good candidates for conversation on this show. He mentioned Gabriel and also mentioned this book in particular called Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making. And then lo and behold, I noticed on their website it won just won an award that I thought, well, why not talk to him about it right now? Before we go any further, however, I have to say that I have always wondered on talk shows, whether they're with famous people or less famous people, meaning famous hosts or less famous hosts, whether they've actually read the book or not. And you can't always tell. So I'm going to tell you right up front that I have not read the book, as I told him. But I really enjoy the music of Monk, and it's a book I'm interested in reading. But this is therefore not going to be a conversation so much about the book as about Thelonious Monk. So, thanks, Gabriel, for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Why Thelonious Monk?
Oh, man. Thelonious Monk, why write a book about him, or why listen to him, or why anything?
What makes you interested in Thelonious Monk? Enough to write a book about
him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've loved Monk's music since I was a kid. My parents had an older friend who turned me on to jazz when I was younger, who was a jazz musician, a saxophone player, and a jazz DJ on a local public radio station. This may be a common story for people who become interested in jazz, I don't know. But he gave me a whole bunch of things to listen to, some Duke Ellington, some Charlie Parker, some Art Blakey, Jazz Messengers, and kind of in a way a little sort of special album. It's just, you know, check this out. This thing's special. It's different. It's, you'll like it. So I put it on and sort of that was it. I mean, from then on I was collecting Monk albums You know, in high school, I listened to him as an undergraduate. I tried in my way to play his music. So there's a kind of fan part of me that when I started work as a musicologist was still lingering there. I still kept thinking about Monk and thinking about Monk, and eventually wrote my dissertation in graduate school on Monk, or anyway, on his music. So that's a personal reason I'm a fan, but I also think he's an exceptional, truly standout musician. He is one of the true greats of the music, and distinctive, different, unusual, and his music and his life, his legacy, which is really what the book is about, I think, primarily his legacy, are unusual in certain ways, and make him a very interesting figure to think about. He was someone who was different from almost everyone around him. He didn't clearly sort of fit into any of the genre categories of his moment, but drew on sort of all of them and contributed to all of them. He played with almost all of the major figures, aside from other pianists, in jazz at his sort of era, both older figures and younger figures. So on one album, he has, you know, Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax and John Coltrane on tenor sax on the same album. So he's sort of pairing the biggest figure from his youth with the sort of latest hotshot, with himself as a little fulcrum between them or something like that.
And Hawkins was the elder, Coltrane.
The
young upstarts.
Exactly. So all of these things, you know, and his music has gone through some very interesting ups and downs in terms of public image or something like that. He was very late to record. His first really significant recordings are from the late 1940s, though he'd been playing. He was born in 1917 and been playing for a long time by the time he finally recorded, whereas most of his contemporaries or even younger musicians in the bop movement or modern jazz movement were recording as early as 42. So he was late to record. And then his music took a long time to sort of find an audience and to take off. It wasn't until the mid-50s, really that he started to get a national and international following. And then with a kind of decline in his health and his public sort of presence in the 1970s, his music fell out of favor a bit and fell into more obscurity. And then in the 1980s, 1982, when he died, at the moment that there was a big upswing in interest in acoustic jazz, in mainstream jazz, also there was a big upswing in interest in him. And so that by the 90s, he had become really, I think, canonized as one of the sort of seminal great figures in the music. So I find that also very interesting about him, just to think about all the ways in which his music might tell us something about the bigger picture of jazz, or might be a case to look at to understand both in the ways that he's maybe common or normal in jazz, but also the way he's abnormal or peculiar in jazz. We can see something about the workings of that music as an art, as a sort of social and cultural phenomenon, as a musical sort of a part of the music industry, and so on.
You brought along a number of recordings, samples of his, and before we go much farther, I don't want to assume that listeners necessarily know what his music sounds like.
Absolutely.
So maybe we should clue them in just a little bit, because it occurred to me when you said at the outset that a friend of yours shared this recording and says, you'll like it. He must have known something about you to make that assumption. Because it's not necessarily a safe assumption, because as you said, his music is kind of different from just about anybody else.
That's right. I think of it as instead of easy listening, it's difficult listening.
Not necessarily.
It can
be. I certainly never found it to be, but then maybe I haven't heard everything.
Fair enough. I think it's a mix. I think at times it's much more kind of tasty and straightforward than people think it is, but there are bits that are pretty hard going. I brought some recordings from sort of three moments in his career. I brought something from this 1948 sort of early first recording, which set him kind of on a path. A whole bunch of recordings from 56 to 58, which I think is the kind of peak moment in certain ways for his output, for his creativity. And it's where he's really hit his stride. And then something from later, from the 1960s, when he's kind of consolidated in a way, and maybe at times a little more uneven. So we might start with the song I Mean You from the 1948 Blue Note recordings. It's a recording that he made with Milt Jackson on vibes, and the drummer Shadow Wilson, who I think is one of the great, if somewhat under appreciated drummers. Monk's music is encapsulated in this. It's his own composition, and he wrote a lot of songs. And it's a little off kilter. It is clearly like a lot of jazz being recorded at the time. It's a song form. He loved song forms. He loved these sort of 32 bar songs that follow a very standard kind of formal model. There's a section, one section that's repeated. Then there's a contrasting section. Then that first section returns. It's a very architectonic little form. Most of the popular music of the early 20th century, at least, was composed in this form. All the sort of Tin Pan Alley greats. I think perhaps you had Jeff McGee on previously talking about that American Songbook.
Right.
Well, this is music that Monk was very familiar with and very interested in, and he loved it, and he composed within that style. But instead of being a person who's composing sort of lyrical, tuneful melodies all the time, some of them are truly sort of jagged and strange. Some of them are lyrical and tuneful, and I brought at least one example of that too, because I think he is a great sort of whatever composer of lyrical songs. But many of them are really much more sort of jagged or pointillistic, and they move around in a way that makes them hard to sing, unlike most of those Tin Pan Alley songs. He's working within the kind of common language of modern jazz, but in some sense, he's creating the common language of modern jazz. So there's a lot of dissonance. There's a lot of rhythmic displacement. He'll play something and then shift that little melody over in time so that instead of falling in the same set of beats, when he repeats it, it'll fall in a different set of beats. So it'll be, you know, shifted over a little bit so that all the accents will be different the second time he plays it. Things like that.
Okay, so this tune is called?
This tune is called I Mean You.
Thelonious Monk on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We're talking with Gabriel Solis of the University of Illinois School of Music. I'm Kevin Kelly. Thelonious Monk, a tune called I Mean You, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and our conversation is Thelonious Monk on the show today with my guest Gabriel Solis of the University of Illinois School of Music, Musicology Department. More of and about Monk in just a moment. Our programs today are made possible with support from Lincoln Square, Starting as one of the nation's first enclosed malls, Lincoln Square has now evolved into a mixed-use lifestyle center. Information on business space and future development projects is available at 217-367-4092. I remember seeing some sort of documentary on Thelonious Monk. I can't remember where or when. But the one image I remember is of him standing in the recording studio and just sort of spinning in place. And I printed out the Wikipedia entry on Thelonious Monk, as I often do for this show. And you always learn plenty of things on there and just hope that it's accurate.
Yeah. But most of it is on that one, for the record.
Is it? Good.
It's reasonable. Good.
Did you contribute anything to it?
I haven't.
But you perused,
but I've looked
you
at
checked
it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, here's what they say about that as it happens. He said he's also noted for the fact that at times while the other musicians in the band continued playing, he would stop, stand up from the keyboard, and dance for a few moments before returning to the piano. One of his regular dances consisted of continuously turning in a counterclockwise fashion. This is the phrase I really am interested in, which has drawn comparisons to ring shout and Sufi whirling. But as I remember, the particular documentary was suggesting that the guy was just nuts.
I mean, ring shouts, whirling dervishes, sure, I guess. I don't know. To me, the most interesting explanation I've heard or seen came from one of his drummers, Ben Riley, a brilliant and great drummer, who said Monk was dancing to the music, and he was a way of sort of being involved and guiding things. He could show what he wanted by little movements he made during the dance. He was conducting, in a sense. And it was his way of acknowledging that the music was really happening. It was good. If it wasn't happening, if he didn't feel like everything was quite right, the rhythm was quite right, the time was quite right, everybody was sort of locking in and syncing with each other and really listening, he wouldn't get up and dance. And so it was a central part of how he communicated with his musicians. And it's peculiar, perhaps. It's unusual, perhaps. But the idea of visual or physical ways of communicating beyond the music between musicians on the bandstand is, of course, very, very normal, and something that the jazz musicians, I think, largely do, show each other in lots of ways that they either do or don't like what's going on.
It would be hard to record that.
Indeed. Right. The question of Monk's mental health is a vexed and complicated one. It's not my impression that you can say simply that he was straightforwardly crazy. That seems untrue. And certainly he was dancing before any kind of decline in his health happened. But there was clearly some decline in his state of mental health over the years. What exactly the nature of it was and what exactly the sort of etiology and all that is very hard to know. There's not great... He was institutionalized a number of times against his will at times, but treated in ways that don't give us any clear sense that the doctors had any idea what was going on, and maybe in ways that made matters worse rather than better. It's a bad and grim story that, you know, is at least partly a result of racism, frankly, and the fear of a man who looked like him, and was maybe at times hard to deal with. There have been some studies of this. I am waiting for a chance to have a look at Robin Kelly's biography of Monk, which is either just out or should be out very soon, and I think will be the first one that is truly authoritative. Kelly worked extensively with Monk's wife or widow, Nellie Monk, and had access to a lot of papers, a lot of documentation that no one else has had access to. So I think that we'll have a better sense of a lot of those questions soon.
Your book, Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk, and Jazz History in the Making, isn't really a biography of Monk, as I understand.
It's not. I do include a short biographical chapter at the beginning to kind of set the stage and give a sense of who he was and what his place was in the music. But really, the book is focused on his legacy, on what other musicians have done with his music and said about his music since his death. I sort of took 1982 as a starting point, though I reach back a little bit before that as well. But I'm really sort of interested in the extent to which he created a body of work, both compositions and recordings, that jazz musicians have found, and other musicians, frankly, absolutely compelling, and on which a number of people have built really their own brilliant statements within jazz. So people like Steve Lacy, who is one of my very favorite saxophonists, who really like spent a great deal of time sort of learning that music and thinking about it and using it as a basis to create a style, which was itself not particularly like Monk's, but very distinctive and very, very, you know, personal. And various people have found one thing or another in his music that really spoke to them. So that's what the book is primarily about.
Was there anybody before him who was playing, technically speaking, quite the way he did? I mean, I also remember taking a jazz class in college and hearing for the first time the term melodious thunk.
Yeah.
Which, you know, every time I want to say his name, I mean, I almost introduced that last tune as "This is by Melodious Thunk." It sort of goes together.
Yeah, yeah, that and The Onlyest. People said, "Oh yeah, you know, my mom or whatever couldn't pronounce his name, and so she called him The Onlyest, and he was The Onlyest," and I like that as well. Were there people technically like him before? His music certainly draws on a host of other pianists. I think particularly James P. Johnson, one of the great stride pianists of the Harlem Renaissance, a person who was both playing and recording and also composing lots and lots of music in the 1920s and thereabouts. But Johnson had a much more conventional technique, in a sense. So the truly kind of oddball technique and the throwing in real sort of unexpected materials is also a bit his own. But if you think about the rhythmic displacements, for instance, the sense in which rhythm is made strange or accents are placed in funny places, I think that's something that is partly common to jazz, but also something he really particularly gets from James P. Johnson. If you think about the way that he uses the piano, not as a kind of single melodic line in the right hand and chords in the left, but rather as a big kind of orchestral instrument, an instrument that's capable of capturing the full range, in some sense, of sort of orchestrations of a piece. There, I think you can hear him looking to Duke Ellington, who he certainly was aware of and liked very much, and is a person who really used the full kind of breadth of the piano, if you will, as an instrument. So those are two people I think he's drawing on.
What's the next selection you brought along?
Well, I had said, I think, in addition to writing these sort of jagged or hard to sing kinds of melodies, though obviously lots of jazz singers have found ways to sing them. Nonetheless, in addition to writing those, he also was very much a musical lyricist. And so I brought what I think is one of his most beautiful kind of lyrical ballads, the song Reflections. This is a solo recording of it from 1959 from an album, Monk Alone in San Francisco. And one of the things you can hear in it, in addition to just a lovely, lovely, tuneful melody, is a way that he plays and that he really draws on, an older tradition of piano playing in jazz, which is that you hear him not so much state a melody and then move on to improvisation on the chord changes, but rather play with that melody in many ways throughout the entire performance, so that he's really a person who works with what you might call thematic integration, that his pieces generally, you hear the melody, the themes of the melody, all through his playing. And also when he's playing with other people as an accompanist, he's usually feeding them bits of the melody, kind of keeping that composition of his alive in all its kind of fullness throughout the whole, you know, 5-6 minutes, whatever.
Okay, so the tune is called Reflections.
That's right.
By and played by solo Thelonious Monk here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. My guest is Gabriel Solis. Thelonious Monk, his own tune called Reflections, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. In the studio with us today is Gabriel Solis, of professor of musicology at the University of Illinois School of Music. He's written a book called Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making. Just came out last year, I guess. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Copyright 08, anyway.
The copyright 08, indeed.
That never necessarily tells you when it doesn't always necessarily tell you when it comes out. Coming up in a little bit, we'll have a short events calendar for you. And at 1 o'clock, weather forecast at 101 News Headlines, and classical music for you at 106. On the show tomorrow is a woman named Alex Sharp, I believe is her last name. I'm sort of blanking on it, but she is one of the four women singers and one woman fiddler who make up Celtic Woman. They're bringing their Isle of Hope tour to Springfield, Sangamon Auditorium, on Thursday. And talked with her last week from Ireland, and we'll air that interview on tomorrow's show. But more about Monk. That tune came from where? From what period then? This was
Second group. That's from 1959, a solo album he released in 1959, recorded in San Francisco. And I think it is really, it's him hitting his stride. It's his most sort of palatable in some ways. It's the easiest to listen to, I think, of his work. He's really in the pocket, and in a sense, and work recorded in that period is I think just consistently brilliant. It doesn't have quite the sort of loose, wild, and a bit crazy sound that the 48, 49 recordings for Blue Note have. For me, at least, they always seem a little low budget and brilliant, mind you, great stuff, but a little on the fly. And then the later stuff, the stuff from the 1960s, is just uneven. Sometimes some of it's fantastic, but some of it tends to sound a little bit all the same. But this stuff from the mid and late 50s is just consistently brilliant.
He was not only musically idiosyncratic, but also visually idiosyncratic.
Indeed. Indeed. The hat and beard. In fact, one of the tribute songs, a whole bunch of songs that jazz musicians have written in tribute to him, or wrote to memorialize him, and one of them is titled Hat and Beard.
That almost sounds like it ought to be a name of a tune.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the number of people put words to his to his songs.
That's right.
And I thought it might be fun to just hear one of those. This happened to be one that both of us own and neither of us has heard in a long time. And let's see, which is the one I just picked? Well, You Needn't, I think.
That's right. Well, You Needn't, with Carmen McRae singing.
Yeah. Is this the original tune name, or is this a renaming of his original tune?
His tune names are all a little tricky because they, in his own work, they shifted. So he would have called it at one point maybe Stickball and then later Well, You Needn't. But Well, You Needn't is the common name for this tune. It's the name most people know it by.
So he would change it because he had changed the tune, or just because he changed his mind, or he took it, whatever. You know?
Who knows?
He was Monk. He could do what he wanted and did.
Indeed.
Here's Carmen McRae, Thelonious Monk's tune, Well, You Needn't. Who's the band with them?
This has Al Foster on drums, George Mraz on bass, Clifford Jordan on tenor sax, and Eric Gunnison on piano.
This is a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed it on Live. Hope you enjoy it on Live and Local.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now. You're dressing with class, well, you needn't. You're holding your sass, well, you needn't. You think you're a gas, well, you needn't. You say that you'll try, well, you needn't. You say you won't lie, well, you needn't. You're starting to cry, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now. It's over now, it's over now. It's over now, it's over now. It's over now.
Carmen McRae and the band playing Melodious. There I am. I'm doing it. Melodious Thunk.
Yeah.
Thelonious Monk's Well, You Needn't, or various other names it apparently goes under, here on Live and Local. He didn't write the words. You said might have been by
The CD here lists these as Mike Farrow. There are a number of different people. John Hendricks wrote lyrics to a number of them, apparently at Monk's behest. So he's the most sort of common lyricist for his tunes. I was thinking as I was listening to that, in fact, one of the ways you know Monk was thinking in terms of song is if you listen to the song, you can almost always hear where the title of it fits in the lyrics Monk must have had in his mind. So, I mean, that one, you know, Well, You Needn't is there. It's in the music. I mean you, it's in the music.
It's a vocal inflection,
absolutely.
Textual inflection.
Yeah.
That's kind of an interesting way to think about it. I'm going to take a quick break here. I promised a calendar, so we'll fulfill that promise.
Perfect.
There's a recital tonight at Illinois State University. If you're into guitar, a guest artist is Elliot Frank. He's giving a master class in 15 minutes, and then his recital tonight at 7:30, both of those at Kemp Recital Hall in Normal. At the Rosebud Theater in Effingham, which we don't mention very often, it's a drive for those of you in the southern part of our listening area, but perhaps worth it. I like the title of this anyway. It's a musical called Church Basement Ladies. Two performances tomorrow at 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock. The Roque Cordero Memorial Concert is at Illinois State University at Kemp Recital Hall. That's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Renowned 20th century primarily composer from that campus. Soprano Nicole Cabell with pianist Spencer Meyer is at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts tomorrow night at 7:30. And Wednesday night at Sangwan Auditorium in Springfield, the Virsky Ukrainian National Dance Company. And back at the Krannert Center, Wednesday night, University of Illinois Symphonic Band 2 and Concert Band 1. They're performing together tomorrow night, Wednesday night at 7:30. If you'd like to get your event on our calendar or tell us about your organization and maybe get them on the show, please let us know at willcalendar@illinois.edu. That's W-I-L-L calendar@illinois.edu. And I'm Kevin Kelly. I'll read that and we'll try to make sure it's on the program. Our program today is made possible with support from Parkland Art Gallery at Parkland College. The gallery's exhibitions and educational programs are offered free of charge to the public. Artist receptions, interviews with artists, and other special programs are offered to interpret the exhibits. I have news headlines coming up at 101, just after our weather forecast. Classical music for you at 106. The focus is jazz today. Gabriel Solis is my guest here on Live and Local. I want to just ask you a brief question about another book that you did with Bruno Nettle of also the musicology department, mm-hmm. Ethnomusicology in particular, whatever that means. It means more and more things anymore, it seems like, but on improvisation.
Absolutely. Well, it's
what's the fascination? Anybody who listens to this program with any regularity will know that I'm fascinated by anyone who can improvise and intensely envious of anybody who can do that. What's the take of that book, or what's your take on improvisation, and how does Monk fit into that?
Sure. Well, the book is a collection of essays by, I really think, some of the most accomplished musicologists at the University of Illinois and elsewhere, looking at improvisation in lots and lots of different contexts and settings. So looking at jazz and looking at improvisation historically in the classical tradition, the Western classical tradition, looking at improvisation as a part of the Indian classical musical traditions, looking at all sort of various places and trying to come up with ways of understanding improvisation as a thing people do in music, but also as a metaphor for thinking about how music relates to social life, or lots of things. There's some very fine essays, in fact, that look at situations where improvisation is either forbidden or simply doesn't happen in music, special kinds of settings that don't allow for thinking about music improvisationally. I guess we want to get a broad sense of what is the range of things that really come under that word. And I think the more you look at things that are called improvisation, the more it seems like not one thing, but lots and lots of different things along a kind of range, from really truly sort of playing things with very little of a preconceived model in mind, to this sort of jazz model, which is that there's a model in mind and people are composing anew, but on the basis of that model in the act of performing. That's how I like to think about it, sort of musical composition on the basis of a model in performance. To settings where what people are doing is really more like sort of variation on a model, but not moving away from it in the way that sort of improvisation usually seems to mean. And one of the neat things about it is exactly the thing that you just mentioned, which is that you get a sense of how different people conceptualize it. So this idea of it as a special thing that people are envious of is certainly a part of it, but also at times it's been seen as a kind of lesser art, not as good as really being able to play the composed pieces, but just faking, as it got called. And in other settings, it's just taken for granted. It's just normal. It's just the thing that people do within the tradition. So it's interesting to see all the different ways that people conceptualize it. I did write some things about Monk in that collection, and one of the points I was making in that is that pieces enter into the sort of common repertoire of jazz because they're exceptional models for improvisation, and really sort of thinking about how do compositions work, not in the way that they might within the Western classical tradition, where what makes them great is their sort of integration and unity and kind of architectonics or whatever, but rather thinking about what does this tune allow in terms of improvisational sort of models or what you can do with it. So My take on it is that, you know, part of what made Monk really unique was that his songs have a very kind of clear voice, a very clear and easy to recognize sort of distinctiveness that runs throughout them. You can tell a Monk composition immediately, but at the same time, they offer musicians a great deal of, or many of them, offer the musicians a great deal of freedom and opportunity to work with, material to work with, but also space to work. Not all of them. Some musicians have complained about certain ones of them that just, there's only so much you can do with it. And those tend to get played a lot less. It's the ones that really open up space, I think, that people play most commonly.
Well, that's why standards become standards, whether by Monk or anybody else.
Absolutely.
Before we run out of time to do this,
yeah.
Before you and I started this conversation, you said there was one tune on the disc you brought that you wanted to be sure we got to at least play some of it, because it's a really long track, which we won't be able to get to. Yeah. Why don't you introduce that, and let's do it.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there's lots and lots of Monk material, and we haven't really played the greatest hits, things like Round Midnight or Straight No Chaser, which got picked up by, you know, Miles Davis and really turned into very, very famous pieces, I think, largely on the basis of that. So whatever, and I guess we probably won't, because time being what it is.
Time is what it is.
Such is life. But one of the things that maybe Monk should be best known for, but I don't know if he is as a musician who's really in dialogue with blues and who wrote blues compositions, or compositions within the blues form. They're jazz pieces, but they're in the blues form, and who played or had his band play really deep bluesy blues. He himself kind of plays, he plays what he plays. He always plays what he plays, but he really authorized certain kinds of playing on among his band members. So this is a song, Bolivar Blues, or the Bolivar Blues Are, or this is one that has a whole bunch of different iterations of the name. Anyway, it's from the album Brilliant Corners, which is from 1957. It has Ernie Henry on alto sax and Sonny Rollins on tenor sax. This is from a period where he was working with Sonny Rollins as a young hotshot. Also Oscar Pettiford on bass and Max Roach on drums. It gives you a chance to hear my Monk, when he picked sidemen, loved to pick hard swinging, real in the pocket inside bassists and drummers. So you get Max Roach and Oscar Pettiford swinging their butts off, and Sonny Rollins playing some blistering kind of blues on this.
Tuned by Thelonious Monk. I had to think about it again. On Live and Local, my guest is Gabriel Solis. Music by Thelonious Monk here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Tell us the name of that tune again, one. That's the one, a bunch of different names.
We'll call it Blue Bolivar Bluesar. That's the full long version. It was written for the Bolivar Hotel in New York City.
Okay. Gabriel Solis is my guest, has been my guest this hour on Live and Local. The book to which we have referred that prompted this conversation is called Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making. He's got another one he edited with, co-edited with Bruno Nettel, collection of essays on improvisation cross-culturally. And this is interesting. Are you still working on this book on Tom Waits and the theatrics of masculinity?
I sure am, yes, yes.
That might be another conversation on another day.
I'd be glad to come in and play some Tom Waits for you.
We'll see how that goes. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And we have support for today's broadcast from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive and Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music. It's going to be a mostly sunny afternoon. Our high will be around 70. Mostly clear early tonight, then increasingly cloudy overnight with a low of 49. Tomorrow, cloudy, periods of rain, maybe a thunderstorm, the high 63, and Wednesday's outlook, mostly sunny, the high 65. We're at 63 now. It is 1 o'clock. We have news headlines in just a minute. Classical music at 106. This is WYLL, FM and HD Urbana, operating translators W293 AF Danville and W266 AF Urbana. We are the listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Celtic Woman on tomorrow's Live and Local from noon to 1. Hope you'll join us.